The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. This morning, we are going to review the recent report on personal care assistance from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And at this time, I would invite Joel Alter and Carrie Meyerhoff from the Office of the Legislative Auditor to join us, and we look forward to your report. Mr. Alter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Joel Alter with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and Carrie is here with me and certainly available to help answer questions as they come up. What I'd like to do is begin with some overall conclusions on this report we released at the end of last week, go into some background on the PCA program, and then talk about our main concerns in this area. Let me begin with a couple of general observations. First of all, personal care assistance has the potential to help many low-income Minnesotans that face very challenging life circumstances lead fuller and more independent lives. It is an important program in Minnesota. Second, there have been some fairly dramatic cost increases in the PCA program that we'll be talking about more in a moment. Even if PCA services are, as some people have pointed out, a last resort when other services aren't available, it would be very hard to sustain the kind of cost increases we've seen in the last few years into the future. Third, there are important weaknesses in the PCA services. The fiscal integrity of the program is threatened by a high incidence of improper payments. The state's oversight of service quality has been insufficient. And we think there's room for more consistency in the assessment of individuals' needs for services. So again, what I'd like to do is just start with a little bit of background on the program, and then we'll get into some of these issues in more detail. I'd like to begin by talking about just what's meant when we talk about the term personal care assistance. And as you know, this is not kind of the high-tech, high-credential part of the healthcare system that ordinarily it seems like we focus on. It's a very hands-on service provided by people who are paid very modest wages. And there are four broad categories of service that are outlined in Minnesota law. First, there is assistance with activities of daily living. And this would be something like helping a person with bathing, getting dressed, grooming, eating. Secondly, there can be assistance with health-related functions. These are services that usually a medical professional would be providing, but in this case, they have been delegated to a personal care assistant, doing something, for example, like changing the dressing on a wound. Third is behavior redirection or intervention. A PCA is not supposed to be providing therapy, but a PCA could intervene, let's say, if there is a child who is threatening a sibling and they've been authorized for PCA services. That might be an example of an intervention that they might make. And a fourth category is called instrumental activities of daily living. These are things such as helping someone with grocery shopping and meal preparation. An individual recipient cannot just receive this service. However, if they are receiving one of these other three categories, they may also be receiving this fourth category of service. PCA services are available to people who meet income and other eligibility requirements as part of certain publicly funded health care programs in Minnesota, mainly Medicaid. And what I'd like to do on this slide is just briefly walk through the process by which people start to receive services. And the first step really is assessment. Assessment of a person's health and need for PCA services. Typically, this is done by a local public health nurse. It could be done in other circumstances by a county case manager or a service coordinator. Usually, there's about a one-hour home visit, and during that time, the nurse would document the health status of that person. They would determine whether the person can direct his or her own care. If not, there would be a responsible party designated for that individual. And the nurse would recommend whether the person should get PCA services, and if so, how much. Now, a majority of the people receiving PCA are getting it through fee-for-service health care. And so for these recipients, the Department of Human Services provides written authorization after the assessment of the actual number of hours of service that they can receive. By this point in the process, usually the individual recipient has selected a provider agency to administer the services. And I'll say more about those agencies in a moment, but just to clarify, this agency is not DHS. This is typically a private non-governmental agency that does kind of the day-to-day administration. And after the services have been authorized, this provider would contact the physician of the individual and get a statement declaring that the services are medically necessary. The next step is development of a care plan. This should always involve the recipient or the responsible party. It might also involve the provider agency, the personal care assistant, a qualified professional, or a physician. And then after the care plan is in place, then the services can be provided in accordance to what's been outlined in the care plan. Getting back to this issue of the provider agencies, again, they play an important role in service delivery. When Minnesota started PCA services back in the 1970s, DHS would make direct payments to the caregivers. The caregivers would send their bills directly to DHS. But now we have this kind of intermediate layer of provider agencies, and there are more than 500 of them that do a lot of the daily administration of PCA services. Many of them are very small businesses, have relatively few recipients. Often you'll find that they operate out of a home office or a small storefront. These agencies are not required by the state to have a state license, and over three-quarters of them are, in fact, not licensed. State law provides for two types of PCA provider agencies, personal care provider organizations and PCA choice agencies. Both of these types of organizations do certain fiscal activities, again, kind of processing the claims, making the actual payments to the personal care assistants. But the personal care provider organization acts in more of an employer-employee relationship. They can do hiring and firing and scheduling and supervising, whereas the PCA choice agency, in those cases, it would be the recipient or the responsible party that's doing more of those activities rather than the agency itself. The vast majority of PCA services are funded from Medicaid, which, as you know, is funded 50-50, federal and state. Over the past few years, we have seen total PCA spending grow significantly. Between fiscal years 2002 and 2007, as we see here, total spending grew by 164%. There was an increase in spending both on the managed care and fee-for-service component of this. On the managed care side, spending grew at an annual rate of about 35%. On the fee-for-service side during this period, the annual increase was about 18%. And so altogether, we've seen the PCA costs grow from around $153 million in 2002 to more than $400 million. Why have the costs grown so much during that time or during a longer time period? Well, all of the growth that we saw on that previous slide was due to an increase in the number of recipients, not an increase in the cost per recipient. I think that's important. The size of the pie and the total number of recipients has grown significantly. Second, since PCA services started about 30 years ago in Minnesota, the legislature has periodically expanded who is eligible to receive them, and it's expanded the types of people who can be caregivers, paid caregivers, for these individuals. Third, as you know, in recent years, we've certainly seen some limits on other types of human services and some cutbacks. We're making less use as a state of regional treatment centers and nursing facilities. Some of the waiver programs have had enrollment caps. And so this has undoubtedly had some impact, too, on PCA's use during that time. I want to turn next to the three main issues that we're going to focus on today that we highlighted in our report. And again, with a program that spends more than $400 million a year, it's important to ensure that taxpayers' dollars are being spent appropriately. And so I'm going to talk first about fiscal integrity. $400 million in the context of the overall Medicaid budget in Minnesota is not gigantic. It's less than 10%. But what's interesting is when you look at the share of the time that fraud investigators in Minnesota spend on PCA services. For example, the DHS fraud investigators spend close to two-thirds of their time on PCA-related issues. The Attorney General's office, during the last 3 years, has devoted nearly half of its Medicaid fraud investigation time to PCA-related cases. And I'd like to be able to say from all of that 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 attention has allowed us to identify all improper payments and act on them. But there are limits to what these investigations can uncover. Many of the DHS investigations, most of them, are done in response to a complaint. There's very little random auditing of PCA agencies. Most of the investigations are pretty narrow in scope. They usually focus on a single individual or on like a single recipient or an individual personal care assistant, as opposed to being a broader look at practices within an agency. When there is collusion between a recipient and a provider, it can be very difficult to detect even during the course of a DHS fraud investigation. And sometimes the only way to get at those kinds of circumstances is if there is some sort of surveillance, and usually that's only done when there is involvement by a federal agency like the FBI, which isn't real frequent. So overall, because the investigations themselves have limited scope, and because there is a limit to the detection abilities of DHS and the Attorney General, we don't at this point have an overall estimate of the total improper payments in a given year. In our report, we do talk about, and I can certainly elaborate on if you're interested in, some of the improvements that DHS has made in recent years in its attempt to detect fraudulent claims and control them. Nevertheless, in our report, we do talk about problems that we found as we reviewed claims data in some depth. We reviewed 1 month's worth of PCA claims from the middle of 2008, and among the things that we found were instances in which providers were paid for more than 24 hours per day for an individual caregiver. In one case, there were 254 hours of service by one PCA in one day. We also found instances in which providers were paid for PCAs who reportedly worked consecutive 24-hour workdays, sometimes multiple days in a row, which seemed very unlikely to us. And even though these cases that are highlighted here aren't a gigantic percentage of the claims that we reviewed, these are the most obvious cases, and I think the question remains, if these cases are not being flagged, what about the less obvious cases that also need some attention? As we proceeded with our study, one of the things we did was to go out to a sample of 26 provider agencies and actually look through the recipient files and look to see whether or not there was compliance with some of the basic state payment requirements, and we found a lot of issues. In more than 20% of the cases we reviewed, we found discrepancies between the amount of time claimed by the PCA provider agency and the amount documented in its records. In about 28% of the cases, we did not find an up-to-date physician statement of need in the recipient file. In about 26% of the cases, we did not find an up-to-date care plan. And in a lot more of the cases, we found that the care plan was not signed by the recipient, which is a state requirement, and it is something done to indicate some involvement by the recipient in the care plan development. In addition, we heard concerns that it is simply too easy to establish a PCA provider agency. Over a recent five-year period, the number of unlicensed provider agencies grew by about 150%. These are agencies that face very minimal requirements in state laws and rules. To the extent that there are requirements, and there are some, DHS does check on some of those things. For example, they check to see that the owners, that there has been a background check of the owner. But for some of the other requirements in state rules, DHS does not verify compliance before the agencies can start serving recipients. Starting in January of 2008, DHS started a three-day training program for owners and administrators of PCA agencies, and we think that has been a very useful thing. We attended the course and found it very helpful, but the training is voluntary, and to this point, less than a third of the PCA agencies have had someone complete the training. Also, DHS expressed concerns to us about PCA agencies that they've taken action against. They put them out of business, and they'll come back into place under a new name, basically the same owners, and DHS feels that it doesn't have authority in statute to really prevent that effectively. So let me briefly touch on what we recommend in our report in the area of fiscal integrity. First, we think the DHS should promptly and regularly analyze its data on paid claims to detect improper payments. This can be done in a variety of ways, but we think to the extent possible, do it up front. Do it in automatic ways through edits, through flags. I mean, you can certainly catch some of it after the fact as well, but to the extent that it can be caught up front through some automatic types of flags, that's a lower resource approach. Secondly, we do think the DHS has to continue to do and enhance, if possible, the number of investigations that it does. This is another way to really dig in and go beyond it's kind of the superficial things and to look for evidence of fraud in more depth. And especially with the expansion of the number of agencies, we think this is important. If it can't be done with existing resources, I should add that there is currently no fee that provider agencies have to pay, nothing like a licensing fee that they would pay, and so that's something that could be considered. Third, we think that the legislature should require agencies to complete that intensive training I was talking about a minute ago, complete that before they even are allowed to do business, and periodically go through it again. Fourth, DHS should be authorized in law to consider provider agencies past noncompliance with state requirements when they're making decisions about whether an agency should be allowed to enroll. And finally, we think there's room for more clarity and specificity about which PCA services can be reimbursed by the state. We heard DHS giving guidance to provider agencies, for example, saying you can't have a PCA helping a child with homework, which we think is a reasonable instruction to give, but those things aren't in written policy anywhere. So we think there is room to clamp down on some aspects of the program that I think would be reasonable and that would provide clearer boundaries to what's allowable and what is not. The second area that I want to focus on is the area of quality, service quality, and about the mechanisms that are in place to ensure that services are high quality and that vulnerable recipients are protected. DHS is supposed to play a leading role in PCA quality assurance, but we concluded that its efforts in this area have been pretty weak. The 2001 legislature required DHS to develop a PCA quality assurance plan. The law outlined a number of specific components for that plan. That plan was never developed. One piece of it that was done that was required by the legislature was a consumer survey that was done once in 2003, but it has not been done subsequently. Until 2006, DHS was one of just a few states that did not conduct regular reviews or audits of PCA provider agencies. And DHS, at the legislature's urging, initiated those types of quality assurance reviews in 2006. But in our judgment, the results have been disappointing. DHS has taken some staff away from that function over time. The number of agencies that it has visited is not particularly large. Rarely is there follow-up in agencies when there are problems found. And in general, the documentation we found in the files was not particularly good. Another way of helping to ensure that PCA services are provided adequately is through ongoing supervision of the services. The law used to require all recipients to have supervision by what's called a qualified professional, and that would be somebody like a nurse. Today, however, the law allows recipients to choose whether they want professional supervision of their services, and we looked at the extent to which recipients are, in fact, being supervised. In 2007, 22% of PCA recipients had no paid supervision by a professional, and that's a percentage that has been increasing over the last few years. In addition, as we looked through client files, we saw a lot of cases where clients were not receiving the frequency of supervision that the statutes required. In general, we're uncomfortable with this notion of professional supervision as an option. We think it can serve a couple of important purposes. It not only helps protect the recipients, but it also provides some accountability accountability to the state and some assurance that the services are actually being provided. By statute, people who are served by PCA agencies are considered vulnerable to maltreatment. And there were a number of issues that we highlight in our report that raise questions about the adequacy of that protection. State law requires PCA agencies to develop what are called individual abuse prevention plans for each adult recipient. Most of the adults whose files we reviewed did not contain those plans. Another issue is, in those cases where maltreatment arises, which agency, which state or local agency, is supposed to be investigating? We found that the statutory requirements in this area are very complicated, and that in some cases the agencies themselves have been confused about their responsibilities. And we also found that the adequacy of the information that the recipients, the consumers, actually get about what are their rights, who do they contact if a problem arises, has not been particularly good. For example, we have in statute a Home Care Bill of Rights. It's supposed to be distributed to PCA recipients, but the general feeling is that that has not been done consistently. A few other quality of care issues that I just want to touch on briefly before getting to our recommendations, in this area. One is that when we reviewed claims for 1 month during 2008, we observed that there were a lot of PCAs reported as having put in some very long work weeks in excess and sometimes well in excess of 40 hours per week. And this raised questions with us either about the quality of care provided or about the accuracy of the time reporting. In addition, state law does not have any real minimum training requirements for personal care assistants, nor does DHS provide specific guidance about what types of training are appropriate. And so often provider agencies and the service recipients are really kind of on their own to determine what training is needed. Also, more than half of the PCA recipients in Minnesota, according to their assessments, have some behavior issues. Yeah. And we heard concern about the nature of the services that they sometimes get. Sometimes PCA is kind of a service of last resort. And sometimes the more therapeutic services are not available. And so we think there is a general issue that DHS and the legislature should continue to consider and work on, which is what is the best way to deal with people with behavior issues. That's a bigger issue than just PCA, but it certainly has an important impact on the use of PCA services. More generally, there is very little information on PCA service outcomes. Again, keeping in mind that we spend about $400 million on this program a year, it would be nice if I could come to you and say, you know, here's what we know about exactly what happens as a result of those expenditures. But other than anecdotes and stories that we hear on individuals, we don't have a lot of systematic information about whether PCA services enhance the health of individuals or whether the services are truly cost-effective. So turning to our recommendations on quality of care, let me touch first on recommendations for DHS. And we have more in the report, but I'm going to touch on a couple of the larger ones. First, we think DHS should improve its quality assurance review program. DHS needs to get out to PCA agencies much more frequently and see firsthand whether they're complying with state requirements, and they should be doing follow-up when they find problems. In addition, we think DHS should provide guidance on topics that personal care assistants need to understand. A lot of that can't be taught in a classroom setting. It's something that may relate to specific services that they're going to provide to a specific individual. But we do think that certain things like how to complete a timesheet properly, good practices for infection control, things like that are universal, and that DHS could provide some guidance on what are these topics that everyone needs to understand. Also, some recommendations for the legislature in the quality of care area. We think it would be reasonable to expect that all PCA recipients will have services periodically supervised by an outside professional. For those people who are in a Medicaid waiver program, they do have case managers who oversee their services, and that's a plus. For the people who are not in waivered services, they wouldn't have that kind of external supervision necessarily. So we think that the non-waiver recipient should also have periodic supervision by a professional. In addition, we think it would be helpful to clarify and to streamline the statutory responsibility for investigating allegations of maltreatment that involve unlicensed PCA agencies. And we've recommended in our report that that responsibility be given to DHS, given that DHS enrolls those agencies and oversees the main services that they provide. The third of the main issues that I want to talk about is assessment. And our concern here is whether there are consistent decisions across the state about who receives PCA services. There is wide variation among counties in the extent to which PCA services are used. And we often see these variations among counties, but we did make an effort to try to control for the fact that there are differences across the state in the number of Medicaid-eligible people with disabilities. Even when we controlled for that, we saw the kind of differences that are shown here. And just to highlight an example, I mean, looking at the counties with under 50,000 population in Minnesota, Beltrami County, its service rate is more than 30 times what Cook County's rate is. The variations aren't quite as extreme in some of the other categories of counties we've got outlined here, but they are significant. And it certainly raises questions about what is the right level of service that that should be provided. We think that one of the plausible explanations for the variation that we saw is differences in the assessment process. The nurses who do these assessments have a very tough job. They go in, as I said, for about an hour. They have a limited period of time to observe the behaviors and the disabilities of individuals. But that's why it's really important to have people who are well-trained in assessment of PCA. And DHS does have some good assessment training, but it's not mandatory. And over the last few years, it's been offered sporadically. Training alone is not a panacea. Even when there is training of assessors, sometimes there are still differences among those assessors in the judgments they make about the services that individuals need. There has been very limited state guidance on the number of hours that should be assigned to individuals. And so some of the assessors that we talked with expressed a lot of frustration. They said they would welcome state guidelines, especially for helping to assess behavior problems. And finally, when you've got 87 counties out there, it's good to have some state-level review to ensure that there is consistency, but that is something where DHS has really not done much review once the assessments have been done of those outcomes. So our recommendations in the assessment area are really three-pronged. We think that people who do assessment should have to meet minimum training requirements. Again, DHS has a lot of training in place already. This would help ensure that people take advantage of that. Second, we think the DHS should provide some statewide guidance on the allocation of time when assessments are done. These guidelines should not be used rigidly. They are just that, guidelines. But we do think that assessors need help, and some guidance is reasonable. And third, we think that assessment outcomes should be subject to some state-level review, whether that's going in and looking at samples of assessment outcomes or looking at summary data. We think there's more DHS could do in this area. A final issue that I want to mention, and that is the issue of licensure of these PCA provider agencies. And this is a topic that has been discussed and debated for a lot of years in Minnesota. Previously, the legislature has passed some licensure requirements for personal care agencies, but ultimately the legislature has backed off when it's learned that the price tag has been, in some cases, substantial. And today we have more of these provider agencies operating, so I assume that the price tag would be even higher than the estimates that were made earlier. The 2008 legislature temporarily exempted all Medicaid-funded PCA provider agencies from licensure. The legislature did this pending implementation of new provider standards from the Department of Health, and those are to be proposed sometime next month. So we will wait to see what the Department of Health proposes, but at the moment, there is no licensure required for any PCA agency. We favor more and better oversight of the PCA provider agencies. We think that could happen in different ways. It could happen through mechanisms other than licensure, through things like the enrollment process that DHS uses to enroll provider agencies, through the quality assurance reviews I was talking about before, through the compliance reviews DHS does, rather than a new licensure process. And so our recommendation, not that we think there's anything wrong with licensure in this area, there's a lot of appeal to having additional oversight regulation, but particularly at a time when resources are scarce, we think it might be best to beef up those other mechanisms first rather than adding a new licensing approach. So just to summarize, again, personal care assistance is a very important service in Minnesota. It is a very important part of our publicly funded health care programs. But at the same time, the costs have increased very dramatically, and it would be hard to justify those continuing cost increases without harder evidence about what we're getting for that. Furthermore, there's a need to improve the accountability, the quality, and the consistency of PCA services, and that's going to require a more active state role. And finally, I think it's important to emphasize the urgency of this. I mean, we are at still the beginning of the curve. We're going to see, as Minnesota's population ages, an increasing demand for home care of various sorts. And so getting a handle on some of these problems in the PCA program will pay dividends in years to come. One other final note, as with all of our reports, we do have at the end of the report a list of all of our recommendations in the report, which legislators sometimes find helpful. We even have a kind of a glossary at the back of this report. This is an area with a lot of technical terms, and it can be confusing to keep a care plan and a service plan straight, and so we decided to give whatever help we could. So those are a couple other things that we have in the report.
Questions? Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple questions. Let's say the legislature did implement licensing. Do you think that would we realize some savings? Do you think that there's just money being wasted? Or I guess I don't exactly know how to ask this question, but what do you think? What is the benefit? The main benefit of the licensure is it better quality care and making sure that we're not wasting money?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, I think there are a couple of benefits from either licensure or improved regulation of the provider agencies. Clearly, there are questions about fiscal integrity when we have agencies that are not always very savvy at running a business. Some of these places have no real track record of running a business, don't know about submitting claims to the state, and so having some additional requirement for them might discourage some of those kind of fly-by-night operations from getting into this business. But I also think there is the potential for quality improvements through this as well. I mean, again, trying to create at least some basic requirements so that those agencies that do clear the hurdles are ones that have the capability to provide quality service. Would this result in savings? I sure wouldn't want to promise that. I mean, licensing does cost money, and regulation does cost money, and it's possible that some of that could be recovered through some sort of a fee on the provider agencies. But it's hard to say. I mean, clearly we think that there is an issue with improper claims and a need to recover more of those and to prevent more of those up front. Whether that occurs through licensure or through DHS doing a better job in its claims and payment process, I mean, I think the more that can be done upfront by DHS during that payment process, as I said earlier, the less that would have to be done in the more resource-intensive things, whether they are quality assurance reviews or going back to do periodic licensing reviews. Those things tend to be fairly staff-intensive.
If I could ask one more question. Madam Chair, thank you. You said that licensure would cost, I don't know what your exact words, but would cost a lot of money or have a fiscal note. Why would that be? Because the department would have to hire people to oversee that then? Is that where the cost would come in?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, that's right. I mean, if we talk with DHS or with the Department of Health about any of the provider agencies that they currently license and regulate, they would tell us that there is a significant staff effort involved in that, and sometimes it can be reviewing documents that are submitted, but it can be going out and doing licensure reviews and things like that. So there is a cost to doing that.
Mr. Alter, two places you have recommendations for increasing the requirements. One is on the provider agencies, and one is on the assessing agencies. Did you, in the report, have specific recommendations for what those minimal requirements should be?
Madam Chair, there is certainly room to discuss, I guess, exactly what the requirement should be. In terms of, let's say, the hours of training, I think in the case of the agency training, I mentioned that DHS has a 3-day course that they have developed that's quite intensive. I would say at a minimum, it would be good to see each provider agency have someone from that agency go through that course before they can do business. So that's an existing course that DHS offers, and I think that would be a reasonable starting point. On the assessor side, DHS similarly has currently its main training course for the assessors is a 20-hour class. So, again, it's something that takes place over the course of about 3 days. And I think that, again, if we're talking about experienced assessors, they may need something less than that. But for someone who is a new assessor, going through that 20-hour training, I would think would be a minimum requirement. And one more thing to add, again, I think the infrastructure for this is in place. These are courses that DHS has up and running, and I wouldn't want to assume that there would be no additional cost. I don't know what the excess capacity is within these courses right now, but I would also say they are in place. It's not that there should be, you know, a huge cost to generate brand-new training that we don't have currently.
Mr. Alter, do you believe that this 20-hour class for the assessors would, if everyone was required to take it, would give us more consistency in our assessments?
Madam Chair, I think it would. I think it's one of the important pieces of improving consistency. Training is part of it, but I think having some guidelines from DHS is a second part of it. And then having some oversight by DHS of the assessment outcomes is the third part. Right now, DHS does training of assessors, and at the end of that training, it does a little exercise where all of the assessors work in groups and they see a video displayed of a client, a hypothetical client, but with real circumstances, and they make some judgments about how much time, PCA time, that person should receive. And in the past, when that little exercise has been done, even the trained assessors often vary quite a bit in what they recommend. So training is important, but I think having some basic guidelines and just having, I think, more ongoing information flowing from DHS to assessors would help improve consistency.
Other questions, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I have the distinction of having Beltrami County in my district, the 30 times more than Cook County, and I just want to put that in the context of a conversation I had with someone recently from my community talking about concerns we both had about cuts we thought were likely to be coming to the Health and Human Services budget. And I asked that person, just based on her experience with many different Health and Human Services funding mechanisms and the need for them, if there was anything that she thought that where money was being spent unnecessarily or unwisely. And in her opinion, at least, she said personal care attendance that she thought in that particular situation there was money being misused. She didn't say fraudulently, but she explained to me that in our community some of these agencies had come in and were actually recruiting people to sign up for these services. And I guess, I don't know if that's a good or a bad, I mean, I know that these are very essential services for the people that depend on them, but it seems like we've kind of structured a system where there's a business incentive to go out and promote. And I just wonder if that's maybe why we have 30 times as many. There may be other reasons, too. I guess I don't know. I'm just asking the question. And I'm wondering whether there's something about the structure of this. Again, this is kind of a new area for me, so I'm just asking the question. Maybe it's a naive one. But if we have to spend all this money within DHS supervising and overseeing, and we know that there are all these problems, is that middle layer there the best use of our money, or would we be better off having a more direct relationship? I don't know.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, first on the question about Beltrami County, and I spoke with the public health director in Beltrami County when we were seeing those kinds of numbers for the very reasons you mentioned, you know, what's going on in Beltrami. Beltrami, I remember, has seen literally close to a 600% increase between 2002 and 2007. I mean, that's amazing. And when we talked to the director there, that person mentioned some of the things you just did, that there has been an influx of provider agencies. They've been very active in kind of getting the word out to people, which, you know, can be both a good thing, but as you mentioned, I mean, if they are kind of recruiting people who don't need services or who are questionable, then there are some questions raised. So we did hear, as we talked with counties, that there are differences both in the number of providers and the level of recruiting activities that go on that could explain some of what we saw in the numbers. Your second issue was kind of whether or not this middle layer of the provider agencies is necessary. And I think that's a tough question. I think that back many years ago, the legislature did that as this program was growing. And back in those days, it was a much smaller program, and yet it was becoming unwieldy for DHS to maintain, you know, this direct relationship with the personal care assistants. And keep in mind, we have over 40,000 personal care assistants in the state. That's a lot of direct relationships that DHS would have to maintain. So I think the hope has always been that by having these intermediate agencies, that they would relieve a little bit of the burden from DHS and at the same time do some oversight themselves that DHS might not be able to do. Clearly, what this report points out is that, again, there are issues even with some of these agencies. They aren't all up to the job. The agencies themselves need oversight. So I'm not sure which would be preferable. You know, I think it's a little bit hard to imagine with such a large system as it's grown to be that DHS would want or would be capable of having that kind of direct connection. But there are issues with the agencies themselves.
Senator Solon?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Alter, it seems to me that in recent years we've had discussion about relative care assistance. I don't remember if we passed the legislation. And if we did is that an area that is covered by this, and how did that factor into your findings?
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, the issue of whether relatives can serve as paid caregivers is the one that you're raising, and we have a brief discussion of that report starting on page 89. That's the first part of Chapter 5. But let me just give you a brief history and an answer about that. When the PCA program started more than 30 years ago, it was not allowable for family members to be paid caregivers in the program. But over time, the federal restrictions on this have been lifted somewhat, and the state has also lifted some of the restrictions. It used to be that you had to go to DHS and get a special written waiver to have certain relatives be paid caregivers, and you're no longer required to do that. The two main prohibitions that are still in the program today is that you cannot be a paid caregiver for a spouse, and you cannot be a paid caregiver for a child under 18. But otherwise, if you are, let's say, a cousin or an aunt or an uncle or, you know, any number of other situations, you can be a paid caregiver. And there's been some controversy about that and a lot of discussion and questions about You know, does that make it easier for fraud to occur when you have people within the same family? Certainly there are risks with that. But we also talked to a lot of people who thought that there is a real benefit to that, too, for a couple of reasons. I know in talking with some of the communities of color, some of the provider agencies that serve primarily minority recipients, particularly immigrant recipients, some of them said it's very difficult to imagine them being comfortable with strangers as opposed to relatives providing services. And so some of those agencies provide literally 80-90% of the services they provide with paid caregivers who are relatives. But the other thing that we heard from some people is when you have a stranger who is providing the care, and they can be very capable people, but sometimes, you know, there is a feeling that a relative is simply more committed to that person and is looking out for their best interest. I heard other people say just the opposite, that sometimes, you know, you wonder as much about the relatives as you do about people that they don't know. So I think there is continuing debate on this, but we didn't feel that there was a need to change current practice in this area. We think there is a justification for relatives serving as caregivers. There are risks, but we think they should be addressed just as all of the risks we talk about in the report should be addressed, through better oversight, quality assurance reviews, compliance reviews, in all cases.
Other questions? Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Alter, on page 18, the table 1.5, it says spending per recipient. So this is how much per person that's spent on that?
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, and just to elaborate on the table, we computed this a different way as well, which may be more instructive because you have certain people who cycle in and out of the program. And so we also computed for a person who is on the PCA program continuously during a 12-month period, what's the average spending for that recipient? And that's a higher amount, obviously. It's about $24,000 per year is the median expenditure for a continuous recipient over the course of the year. But, yes, you're interpreting that correctly.
And then, Madam Chair, this units per recipient, what does that mean?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, and we're getting into the PCA jargon here, a unit as the term is used for PCA, is 15 minutes of service. And so when assessors go out and recommend how many minutes of time should a person get, that is computed in units. So 4 units would be an hour of service. But that's what that reflects there, is the number of 15-minute intervals per recipient per year.
Thank you. And I just want to thank you for this report. And I would just say that, I hope this doesn't hurt anybody's feelings, but it just seems like this is a lot of money per person, and I don't know. It just kind of I'm questioning whether or not we can afford this. And I have one other question, Madam Chair. Maybe you can answer this. I did actually have somebody call that had a personal care assistant, and the county, they got a letter from the county saying that the county could not afford it anymore and was going to stop doing it. Is the county able to do that? Does anybody know the answer to that?
I believe the only way the county could discontinue would be if they found the person not in need of the service. This is a Medicaid service, and it's statewide. So a county couldn't decide just to discontinue providing the service in general.
Madam Chair, just to add to that, I mean, the only role of the counties is in the assessment part of the process, and they are directed to do the assessments. I've heard some concerns from counties who've said, we don't get enough in payments to cover the cost of doing the assessments, but I don't think they have the option of not doing them.
And I would just also say that, out of the you start to add up some of this stuff out of the 5 million people that we have here in the state. This is a lot of money, and I guess I think we're going to have to take a hard look at this. I think we need to take a hard look at everything, but we're going to have to take an especially hard look at this, because this is a lot of money per person.
Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just remind us that part of the reason that there is significant growth and part of the reason that there's significant dollars is really the result of a very, I think, conscious policy decision that happened long before I was here. But at some point in time, a decision was made to move from institutionalized settings to more community-based, home-based. So I think while you point out some striking numbers, it's important to remember that that was a policy decision that was made, and we're seeing the effects of that direction, I think. But, Madam Chair, I wonder, first I want to commend the auditor for pointing out that while our expenses in this area have increased, I am especially appreciative of the fact that you've pointed out some of the reasons for that increase, because so often we hear about Health and Human Services spending increasing exponentially, and it is clearly pointed out here that this is the result of some policy decision over the long run that it might have an impact on the availability of services in various parts of the state, and decisions about who's to be served. So I think that that's really important to recognize and point out, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. But, Madam Chair, my question really is, I wonder if we would be here today if the legislature had received the report on this program in terms of the quality that was required by the 2001 legislature. I wonder if now in 2009 we would be having this discussion if we had that mechanism in place. And frankly, it troubles me that it seems to have taken the legislative auditor's report to sort of bring this to the surface. I can't imagine that this is a new finding for the agency.
Well, Senator Lynch, I have a couple of comments in regard to your comments. The first is that, yes, the PCA program was designed to help people not need to rely on institutions. But the question that you have to ask yourself is, are all of the people that are in the program today, if we didn't have it, would they be in institutions? Or, you know, are people kind of getting in on the program in spite of whether they have that level of need? And the second thing I would say is that I have been pressing for an auditor's report on this subject for a number of years. And we actually got on the list, and then the person in the auditor's office who could actually go out to the agencies left the auditor's office. And so that year we had sort of a more of a look at the department, but not at the agencies or the assessors, which I think was an incomplete look at the issue. And so it isn't that we haven't known that this was an area that needed a look. It was a number of circumstances that prevented it from being as thorough as this report has been able to be. Let me see. I'm making a list here. Senator Sharon was next.
Thank you. One of the in the discussion of what's growing the cost of this program and trying to do the analysis that Senator Lynch is talking about, you mentioned that caps on the number of waivered services is a part of what might direct people to go to PCA services where they might otherwise be eligible for waivered services, if I understood you correctly. Now, so I need you to help me understand. Go slow and be simple in your explanation as to whether or not an increase in waivered services would answer some of the problems that you're talking about here? Are those better supervised? Are those quality assurance measures in place? And is there better cost containment, or is it simply a shift? Would it simply be a shift of expenditures if we looked at our number of waivered services?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think that's a good question, and it actually is one that DHS may want to address themselves. But let me say this. With waivered services, you do have a county case manager or a service coordinator who is overseeing the services and trying to align them with other things that the recipient needs, which is something that you don't have in kind of standard medical assistance PCA services that are not under waivers. So that's one plus. As far as the oversight, I mean, I'm not a real expert on the extent of DHS's oversight of the waivered programs to know exactly how much that is and whether it's better than what's offered in the PCA program. You know, just to clarify, though, that if there were expansions of the waiver programs, people could continue to receive PCA services through the waivered program. It's, in other words, they could still be receiving PCA services as one component and as part of the waivered services. So it's not like PCA would go away. It would become one component of maybe a broader array of services that they would get. It's not a real clear response, perhaps, and again, maybe the department can offer something more about the oversight of the waivered services.
Mr. Alter, maybe just to elaborate on your answer, you could tell us, when you were looking at the personal care assistant program, did you look at personal care assistant services that were provided within a waiver at all? Or,
Madam Chair, we did look at both. We focused on all types of fee-for-service clients, those who were served by a waiver as well as those who were served by street regular medical assistance programs. But we didn't, you know, in terms of looking at the oversight that those services received, other than looking at the supervision that we saw when we went through client files, we didn't look at what DHS was doing, let's say, to oversee waivered services.
But did you see any difference in the variation or the problems that existed?
Madam Chair, I think that the general problems that we raise in this report about fiscal integrity and quality of service, I think they pertain to people in general in this program.
Senator Erickson-Rolps.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was sort of related to Senator Lynch's question about the growth in costs, and then to a point that you made about ensuring or finding a mechanism to ensure that the people getting the services are actually keeping them in their homes as opposed to moving into more expensive assisted living or nursing homes. And yet I'm wondering, if we tune this up to the point where it does what we want it to do, it seems to me that over the next 15 or 20 years, these costs are still going to continue to skyrocket because of the age wave. So that even as we make this program more efficient and regulated, the costs are just going to continue to become more enormous as more and more of us move into those older ages. And so I was wondering if you had a comment about that, because that age tsunami layered over the top of the best programs that we have are going to cause huge increases.
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson-Rolps, on page 22 of the report, we just provide the state demographer's estimate, which is that between the years 2010 and 2030, the population of the age 65 and older population is projected to increase by 92%. So clearly the pressures are going to increase, and I think whether or not costs will increase depends a lot on the policy choices that you as a legislature make and what the boundaries of the program will be and who will be eligible and for how much service and that type of thing.
Well, and Senator Erickson-Rolps, the most troubling part of this is not, to me, is not growth that's commensurate with the growth of need in the community. But the growth that I've seen, in my opinion, is not commensurate with the growth of need in the community. So there's something not aligned properly, is my concern here. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm Mr. Alter, I don't know who would answer this, but what is the distinction between the PCA agencies and the home care agencies? And is there an overlap in their services? And do people receive services from both types of care?
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, and this always gets confusing, and I still work to sort it out myself, but there are licensed home health agencies licensed by the Department of Health who provide PCA services, and they function like a personal care provider organization, which I was showing you on the slide before. You've got those personal care provider organizations and PCA choice agencies. Some of those are licensed home health agencies licensed by health. Again, the majority of agencies are not licensed by health, by DHS, by anyone, but there is about, you know, we can think of it as roughly a quarter or a fifth of the business within the PCA program that is done by licensed agencies, home health agencies, and they are subject to the kind of review that the Department of Health does as part of the licensure process. There are there are certain things initially that they have to meet that a PCA agency would not otherwise have to meet.
So, Madam Chair, a follow-up then. So a home health agency is licensed, and they do provide similar services to the PCA agencies.
They can, yes.
Or they can?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Alter, of the PCA agencies that are not licensed, and you have 164% increase in this area, did you ever look at is this a lucrative business? That's a tremendous amount of growth, and I'm just wondering the profit margin and is it just because of the needs out there and these agencies popped up, or is this just a lucrative business?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, the quick answer is we don't know. There's no good information statewide to tell us anything about the margin that these businesses get. What I can tell you is this. They get paid by the state roughly $16 per hour for the PCA services that they provide. When we went out to PCA agencies, we looked at the wages of the individual recipients, and for a sample of recipients, we found that the median wage was in the neighborhood of $10.50, and that can range. I mean, there are some agencies that rely more on the clients to do the hiring and the supervision, and they may be paying $12 an hour to their PCAs. So it can vary from $9 to $12 an hour, but $10.50 is about the middle point. So that's the difference between what's being paid out to the PCAs and what the agencies are getting from the state. And there are things, obviously, in addition to that, there's some overhead expenses. I mean, you'd have agencies that would have to pay for perhaps rent and utilities. They have to process claims. They have to pay for background checks on their employees. They have to cover workers' comp, unemployment insurance, liability insurance. And so we heard from some agencies who gave us estimates of what those costs amount to, but the bottom line is I can't tell you exactly what the profitability of the agencies is.
Senator Rosen, and I tried last session as a part of the budget balancing that we had to do last year to limit the administrative expenses of PCA agencies, and it was very difficult. It ended up being something that we couldn't do. Now, that doesn't mean I'm completely satisfied that the administrative costs for all of these various sized organizations are appropriate, but very difficult to address that issue.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen.
I'm not saying it's improper to make a profit, because this is a business. But I'm just wondering. It does seem a little skewed that you have this many agencies, 500, providing these services with this amount of growth, and
right.
and three-fourths of them are not licensed. Or
right. And from my perspective, you know, I'm sure some of these agencies have many more clients than others. And yet, you know, if they're all having to pay rent to be someplace, you know, is it efficient to have very few clients? Mm-hmm. No. It isn't about whether you make a profit. It's about efficiency, in my opinion, of how we operate
right.
the administrative portion of this.
And, Madam Chair, just to, if you're interested, on page 53 of the report, there's a table that gives you an idea of the size of the agencies by the number of recipients that they serve. And you can see pretty quickly that the vast majority, a majority of the agencies out there are serving 15 recipients or less, which is not a lot. These are pretty small operations typically.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
And, Madam Chair, I'm really just asking this question because I don't know what the answer is, but since you've been looking at this for some time, I guess I'm just wondering if, you know, if we're going to be seeing cuts to Health and Human Services agencies, and there's a 40% amount of this these dollars that are just going to the intermediate agency, would it and the DHS is having to do the assessments and oversight anyway, would that money be more beneficially used to support someone within the agency as opposed to, you know, to kind of help them absorb some of the cuts that we may be seeing?
I think maybe that would be a question that you could ask when the department comes up.
Okay.
Other questions for Mr. Alter? Yes, Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go back a little bit to kind of the key here seems to be, I mean, I think everybody understands this is a really critical service to keep people in a lower level of care when it's appropriate. But are we getting the right people? And when I see the wide ranges of the counties that Senator Olson was talking about, up to 30 times in otherwise similar counties population-wise, do we need to impose some state standards on the statement of medical need necessary to actually qualify as a recipient of these services? Are there any recommendations along those lines? I mean, I'm guessing we have counties acting in very different ways in terms of their assessments to determine whether clients are able to qualify for these services, and maybe that's an area that would be ripe for us to look at in terms of trying to make it uniformly applied across the state.
Mr. Alter.
Madam Chair and Senator Laurie, I don't think the physician statement of need is probably what's driving the differences among the counties. That's something that is typically done kind of after the fact, after the assessment has been done. It can often be a little more pro forma. I think the issue is probably at the front end of the process with the assessments that are done, where, as I said, there's certainly opportunity for differences in interpretation by the nurses who do the assessments and judgments about how much time is needed. I mean, they may come to similar decisions about what the health circumstances are for an individual, but one nurse may say, well, that person needs 9 hours of service a day, and another may say, that person needs 4 hours. So providing some guidelines, which is one of our recommendations, I think is one of the components of improving consistency.
But, Mr. Alter, I think part of Senator Laurie's question goes back to the issue of, is this a service that is really needed by everybody who tries to access the service? Clearly, it's needed by very many people that use the service, but is there some percentage that don't need the service but would like the service? And is there a better way to try to determine that, rather than how many hours each person should have? I think that was his the direction of his question.
Madam Chair, and I think that, you know, that part of what an assessment does is not just to determine the number of hours or minutes that a person should receive, but whether they should receive services. So I think to the extent that that assessment process can have some boundaries about what is appropriate and what is not appropriate, who should receive services and who should not, again, I think the assessment process is an important place where those decisions are made. And if the legislature wants to provide some direction, I think that's entirely appropriate.
Mr. Alter, when you looked at the assessment process, the assessors, did you look at how many people are ever denied any service?
Madam Chair, we did not. And I'm trying to remember if there is even very good information on that. Because we were, I'd have to get back to you on that. I can't remember.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Sharon?
I really agree that we should take a look at the assessment process and probably develop some guidelines. What I get concerned about is that that in an effort to try to make certain that everybody makes absolutely the same decision about the assessment of need, that you start overly centralizing assessment processes, and then that creates a whole other set of difficulties that I can see beginning to play themselves out a little bit in this STS service assessment process through MNET, which is a centralized assessment services that lacks a local look at the situation, and spends a lot of money in arguing and fighting between people about denials of service levels. So although on the one hand I really think this is a good place to be looking for direction, I'd be very cautious about becoming overly heavy-handed about pulling away from a local voice in the assessment or need services.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think what we're trying to do is perhaps bring things into a little more balance here, because the assessment decisions, which are made by local public health nurses, really can drive the costs of this program to a significant extent, and yet that's kind of where the county role ends. And so we're simply saying DHS could play a somewhat stronger role in this through providing some guidelines, some oversight. We think it's appropriate to continue to rely on the local public health nurses, but let's make sure they're well-trained and that they have the proper guidance and that type of thing. So just kind of putting the state and local roles into balance.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much. Thank you for the work you did on this report. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner of Continuing Care. Department also had a group looking at personal care attendant services and trying to make some suggestions about what could be done to improve the program.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lauren Coleman. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. I'd like to also allow Alex to introduce herself.
And I'm Alex Bartolik. I'm the Director of Disability Services with Continuing Care Administration.
Thank you for allowing us to make some comments about the PCA service and the OLA evaluation. I'll first like to thank Mr. Nobles and Mr. Alter and Ms. Meyerhoff. We view the report as having good balance and raising the critical issues that we need to discuss. We support the recommendations and think that the year we spent in participating in the evaluation was time well spent. Minnesota started the personal care attendant program in 1977, and it was primarily meant for individuals with physical disabilities that could direct their own care, and the personal care attendants that were providing that service. The program has been expanded over the years in several different ways to serve people with developmental disabilities, individuals with behavioral and mental health needs, and those that can't direct their own care but have a responsible party to do so. As already discussed, this expansion has been the result of several driving factors. The deinstitutionalization that we're all familiar with, and the federal requirements to provide the least restrictive setting. Limits on the disability waivers have certainly been a contributing factor to the growth. And then the availability of other services in the communities, whether it be nursing facilities, assisted living, other services that are available for people with disabilities, and older individuals. That is a contributing factor to the growth of this program. The last 5 years, certainly the growth has caught the attention of the department, the legislature, health plans, consumers, advocates, and most recently the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We've attempted to manage through this growth with a number of actions while the program has been growing. Some examples, some of which you've already heard of, but developing training for the public health nurses who are completing the assessments, having meetings with stakeholders in each of the last 5 years to try to refine the program, implementing further documentation and forms requirements for the agencies and the individual PCAs, timesheets, for example, requiring all personal care attendants to enroll and be assigned a unique identifying number so we can track each of the 40,000 individuals who are providing personal care assistance. Changes to the assessment form along the way, training, as we've already discussed, addressing pooling of PCA hours, which was a challenge to try to manage or eliminate that feature of the program. Improved communication between the recipients, the program participants, the providers, counties, public health nurses, et cetera. And in 2008, initiating the Home Care Advisory Work Group to advise the department, which Alex will address shortly. We have developed a standardized curriculum to train assessors and have been providing that training. Additional physician training was provided statewide to try and instruct physicians in their role and their guidance. We strongly agree that improvements are needed in this program. Although I'm not able to discuss the details of the governor's budget with you this morning, if you were here this afternoon, I could, but this morning I can't. I will be returning next week. I think we're scheduled for Tuesday. And you will hear about our PCA reform proposal. But several of the topics that have been raised this morning will be addressed in our proposal. We will be recommending a more objective assessment instrument and protocols. We call it COMPASS, a comprehensive assessment tool. We will be recommending mandatory training of all who are involved in the PCA program, the agencies, staff, professionals that oversee the staff, et cetera. We'll be recommending changes to access in the program for those that are most appropriate to participate in the personal care assistance program. We'll be recommending mandatory training and guidelines for the assessors who are doing the assessment and credentialing of those individuals so that we can be better assured that we get the same results throughout the state. We'll be recommending limitations on the number of hours personal care attendants can work. We will be assuring responsible parties are aware of their role as a responsible party. We'll be recommending standards for agency participation and annual documentation of compliance of those standards. And then additional ongoing evaluation and monitoring of the program and the results in measurable terms. We recognize that the programs must change and have been changing as the needs of the people in the communities have been changing. But I would also comment that we will never be done. We will never complete the task of evaluating and changing this program. It's likely, as history has taught us, we'll be back in 2 years with more information, different circumstances to recommend further improvements or modifications to the program. So we never believe that we will be complete in reforming the program and it will last forever. But our goal is to focus the program on those that are best able to participate in the program so we can sustain the program as a valuable tool in helping people remain in the community and remain independent. We can answer questions. We can provide some background on the home care advisory work group. However you want to proceed, Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner, is one of the recommendations that the agency will be making through the governor's budget that PCA organizations not be allowed to recruit clients?
Madam Chair, the I wouldn't say that that is a specific recommendation. The individuals who are eligible for the service should go through an appropriate screening, an appropriate assessment, and determination made through that mechanism. Whether people are recruited for the program or not is something difficult for us to determine.
Well, Assistant Commissioner, I asked the question because it's been raised here today during the hearing, and it is something that I have heard about for quite a while. You know, somebody wants to start an agency, and so they go door knocking to get enough clients so that they can start an agency, or potential clients so they can start an agency. I mean, it seems hard for me to believe that we've had the growth in the number of agencies that we've had out of sheer volunteers coming forward saying, I want a PCA. I need a PCA service.
Madam Chair, I think what you will see in our recommendations is that we have not applied the standards that are needed to operate and manage a business in this program. And so the entry into the business, as evidenced by the growth over the last number of years, needs to be examined, and we need to do a better job in making sure that the business practices are, in fact, in place with each and every one of the agencies that we do business with.
Well, you didn't exactly answer my question, but I guess we'll have another chance to ask you about it. Are there questions for Mr. Coleman or Ms. Bartolik? I guess, and perhaps this would be a better question to ask when we see the recommendations, but how many of the recommendations that are going to be coming forth from the agency through the governor's budget were things that were discussed or were raised as a part of this working group that you put together?
Madam Chair and members, the working group discussed a number of recommendations, and the majority of them are incorporated into the recommendations in the budget.
Okay. And were there any that were not included?
Yeah, the seven areas that the recommendations addressed were consumer rights, how to assure that people have good education and understanding of the program and their safeguards for health and safety. And we've addressed some of those. Improved PCA assessments, which there's been a discussion about now. Training for assessors, for the PCAs themselves, as well as for the businesses, and recommendations are incorporated. Care coordination and service delivery was another area, which is also touched on in the recommendations. The one area that is not specifically addressed is workforce development and access to services, which was really trying to deal with how how are we going to find the actual workforce members over time as our state ages? And that's one that there will probably need to be additional work in the future. Administrative simplification and streamlined processes were another area of recommendations, and then quality assurance. So it was only the workforce development that we did not address.
Okay. Question, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was the criminal background checks discussed on this, too? Because it said here that in the 05 DHS study, there's only 19% of the assistants, personal care assistants, completed their background check. That's my first question. Are you going to address that? Because at $10.50 an hour, which was reported from the office, the OLA, you know, that's a minimal living wage. So I'm just wondering if you are taking care of that end, and what is the cost of a background check too?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I think further in the report it will demonstrate that due to the enrollment of each of the personal care attendants and their unique identifying number, that the compliance with criminal background check is quite high. That feature of having to identify each individual in order to bill and then be able to check whether they have a criminal background check, I believe got it up into the 90 percentile range. So that had a good consequence to that. The cost of the background check, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with, $20 is for each individual.
For each individual.
And Mr. Coleman, with the unique identifier number for every provider of services, is there no longer any sort of subcontracting of substitutes for a personal care attendant allowed? Or would the substitute receive their wages through the personal care attendant that has the provider number?
Madam Chair, in order for an individual to be paid as a personal care attendant for that service, they have to certify, and the recipient has to certify, that they provided that service. That doesn't mean that there's only one personal care attendant ever providing service to the program participant. They can have several PCAs assigned to them or hired to provide the service.
I understand that, but you know, in the old days, somebody hired a personal care attendant, and even without knowing at the time when they would hire somebody, they would be told, I'm not going to be available on Saturday, so Jose is coming over and will be taking care of so-and-so on Saturday. And they had sort of a subcontracting method that they used within.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm not aware of a subcontracting method for those who are not enrolled as a personal care attendant.
Other questions? I guess not. I'm sure there'll be more later.
Thank you very much.
So we have the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services to come back today to do a little bit more of an explanation of their unallotment. Unallotment within their agencies. We have Mr. Combe and Ms. Rankin would like to do their presentations together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Craig Akam. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Health. With me today is Jane Rankin, the Budget Director at Human Services. And thank you again for the opportunity to come back and present the information that wasn't presented at the previous hearing. We brought spreadsheets today to talk about the unallotment that occurred as part of the governor's solution to the $426 million deficit in the current year providing more detail where that money came from each of our agencies. I'd be happy to walk through my spreadsheet, and I'm sure Jane would be happy to walk through hers. And because we have a lot of similarities in the way we approach the strategy of this unallotment, we thought we could answer questions together. So to start, if you look at the spreadsheet that says Minnesota Department of Health at the top, as you recall from my previous testimony, we were asked to provide 10% of our unspent fiscal year 9 operating dollars as part of an unallotment plan, which was due to the governor's office on January 2nd. That amount came to $1.7 million for the Department of Health. As you can see by the spreadsheet, we basically looked toward three categories of funding within our agency, of general funding within our agency, to meet that $1.7 million target. The first of which is the middle column, for which there was $823,000, basically in carry forward from the previous fiscal year. As you understand, we're coming to the end of a biennium. The money from the first year of the biennium rolls forward into the second. This was unspent dollars that we had held in reserve, anticipating, in part, that there would be a deficit with a bad economic forecast this November. Obviously, the forecast was worse than we projected. And so we held back $800,000 as an agency in terms of having a reserve to meet an unexpected need.
And when you say you held back, does that mean that there were positions that were intentionally not filled, or was it other expenditures that someone decided not to make?
Both, Madam Chair. And so as you are aware, all the state agencies were asked to enter into hiring restrictions last February as part of the worsening economic situation in the state. Some of that money was salary savings. Some of that money was other expenditures that were foregone in the face of declining revenues. The second amount, which is the last column, we, in the 2007 session, received special language as part of the budget bill that was passed that allows us to carry forward general fund dollars from the previous biennium for IT infrastructure improvements. There was about $200,000 left in that fund. We forwarded that as well as part of the unallotment strategy. And then finally, the first column, there's $676,000 worth of projected salary savings left in this year. Obviously, that money has not materialized. That is based on our internal projections, based on our current complement of staff, projecting out the cost of continuing to the end of June 30th. We are anticipating that we will have $676,000 of savings, but we don't actually have that money in hand. That's our current projection. And so we basically looked at each of our appropriation units or our program areas and defined what we thought we could pull out based on current salary projections in terms of contributing to this unallotment amount. So
are the salary savings that you're projecting based on projected vacancies, or would they require layoffs?
They do, Madam Chair, they do not require layoffs. They're based on projected vacancies.
And I guess about half of the salary savings comes from one program, if you could just explain that a little bit further.
Right. Appropriation Unit 033 is the Environmental Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program that was enacted by the legislature in the 2007 session. It basically allowed for $900,000 a year in fiscal years 2008, 2009, and then next year it drops to $400,000 per year for the 10-11 biennium. Because it was a new program area and there was some infrastructure and startup time and costs, we didn't spend all the money in the first year of the program, and so that represents some salary savings that had rolled forward into the second year, which we did not spend, and will not and offered as part of the unallotment strategy.
And so how many total positions for 2008 and projected to the end of the biennium are you anticipating holding open?
Well, that's a difficult number to say. You know, I would say that if you look in our biennial budget system, Madam Chair, in essence, we are looking at approximately 30 less positions in the fiscal year 2010, and that's based on FTEs rather than positions, than we were in 2009.
And what about 2008? There's some savings there, actually more than there is for 2009.
According to the biennial budget system, Madam Chair, in 2008, the Department of Health had 1,306.7 full-time equivalents. In 2009, we had 1,327. And next year, with inflation, we're down to 1,262. Without inflation, 1,299. Those are our projections, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, maybe we can ask Mr. Godfrey to calculate that for us.
Sure.
Are there other questions about the Department of Health's presentation? Okay. Ms. Rankin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jane Rankin with the Department of Human Services. And I'm going to be talking through a letter that you all have in your packet with the DHS letterhead. It's addressed to Senator Berglund and members of the committee. And the first page has the runs down the appropriations, allotments, and amounts that DHS turned to in order to respond to our instruction from the MMB agency about our administrative unallotment. I would like to point out that unlike the health department, we were not given a 10% administrative unallotment reduction target. We were instead given a dollar amount of $6 million, which is about equal to 4%. Of our agency operations. So there's a slight difference there. The detail that explains the numbers on the front page are on page 2 of the memo. In many aspects, I think the Department of Human Services story is similar to what you heard from the Health Department. Of the $6 million unallotment target, most of it, $4.5 million, came from agency-wide operations funding. And in order to understand where that came from, I need to back up a little bit to last session and the 4% base reduction that the agency had at the end of session for our agency-wide operations. Also, there was a PT contract reduction from last session, and there were some other, we had a few federal compliance initiatives last session that were not funded in the budget, but we were had to figure out a way to fund them anyway. So what the senior management at the agency did after the 2008 session is developed a plan to come up with centralized reductions at the agency in order to meet all of those challenges. It was also the larger context, as Mr. Akam mentioned, since a year ago now, the governor has imposed a sort of a soft hiring freeze on agencies because the entire administration was aware of the possible risk in our economic situation and wanted to make sure that agencies were being prudent managers of the resources that they've been entrusted with and the priorities that they've been given by the legislature and the administration. So in the process of managing towards that reduction, at DHS Central Management, they made decisions after last session to eliminate about 50 FTEs. And my understanding is that there were also, as a result of that, 7 layoffs. The FTEs came from all of the business areas in the agency. My information is that Children and Family Services, health care, and continuing care had the largest number of FTE reductions. And in general, the strategy throughout the agency has been to try to manage within the normal attrition that we see at the agency. So if there's a retirement or someone's leaving the agency, it's a matter of looking to see whether the work that person was doing could be reassigned and distributed, and not necessarily hiring to replace them. I understand that in the children and families area, the largest number had to do with the PRISM activities, that there were 10
Can
FTEs.
Can you speak up? The what activities?
PRISM.
PRISM, okay.
10 FTEs from that. In healthcare, Madam Chair and members, one of the areas that specifically was delayed is the new patient incentive program. And other than that, I would say in general the approach in all of the business areas was to try to focus the lack of resources on things that don't directly impact clients. So, for example, there might be a delay in responding to county policy questions in the healthcare area, or there might be a delay in continuing care of assessing assurance with federal guidelines about the waivers. The result of those decisions meant that when we got the direction for unallotment, we were able to tap $3.7 million from a centralized agency pool from our operations, which we had otherwise, that was carried forward from fiscal 8 to fiscal 9. Like the health department, we're budgeting on a 2-year time frame, so we always have to make sure that we've managed our resources so that we don't run out of operations funding before the end of the biennium. I would say that in general, anything that if we had not been asked to do the unallotment action by the governor now, this funding would have canceled at the end of the biennium and would have been returned to the general fund. So it's just it's mostly a matter of us managing so that by the end of the biennium we are not out of money. So of the $4.5 million of this centralized agency pool, $3.7 million was carried forward from fiscal 2008. There was another $800,000 that we had held in reserve in case we had to pay separation costs. Now, aside from those two parts of our operations funding, then we tapped a few other places to come up with our $6 million unallotment. One of them I mentioned last week. We decided to forego 1 year of our desktop replacement plan, and that got us a value of $350,000. We also were able to unallot $650,000 from our central lease account, and this was really a one-time savings. We had had a situation last year where a building that we were leasing was damaged from flooding, and the building became uninhabitable. So we were able to relocate the personnel from that building to our central office, and we were able to then forego the monthly lease that otherwise we would be paying on the building. And that one act accounts for the bulk of the $650,000 that we were able to unallot from the central lease account.
And Ms. Rankin, that building was not, we're not planning on leasing that building beyond the year?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that is my understanding, yes. And then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the last piece of our unallotment came not from administrative costs. And I wanted to kind of take a segue here just to say that when the direction came from MMB to do our administrative unallotments, agencies were given the flexibility to look to other sources of funding if they had something that they considered would be a good candidate. And that was something that MMB reserved the right to disapprove. We submitted our unallotment plan to MMB the first Friday in January. And at that point, then, they reviewed it and got back to us with questions. And one of the things they did ask about was this $500,000 from our alternative care grant program. They approved our use of that money for unallotment, primarily, I think, because it was a one-time situation where, although normally the alternative care grant program, if there's extra funding at the end of the year in that program, it cancels to the MA account. In this case, there had been a relatively recent change in law about the treatment of estate recoveries. And that relatively recent change in law hadn't been caught by and picked up in our forecast of the alternative care program. So that we had a situation where for this 1 year we had expected recoveries of $500,000 that were coming in and were not budgeted to be needed for recipients. So there's no impact on recipient care from unallotting this money. And I think that's why we were approved to use this $500,000 towards our unallotment. The last thing I would say is that I think it was either the afternoon of the day that I was here last week or the next day we got official notice from MMB that our unallotment plan had been approved. And we, like the other agencies, are now in the process of doing the accounting transactions that we need to complete the process. And they will be all completed by either the end of this week or next week.
Ms. Rankin, is the PRISM project finished? It's about 2 years overdue.
Senator Berglund, members of the committee, I don't have the information to answer that question. I'm sorry. I will take your question back.
Well, I guess I'm just asking if there were 10 positions that were not filled or were removed from the PRISM project. Question would be what the future of that project is if it's not completed.
Senator Berglund, I will note your question.
Ms. Rankin, another question that I have is in regard to we have heard that the governor is doing some further unallotments in the Merck area, and we wondered if A, that's true, and B, if this unallotment process is going to be a continuing process, if there will be a mechanism for notifying the divisions when this is happening.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, as to the whether an allotment is an ongoing process and the mechanism to notifying the legislators, I'm afraid I can't speak to that because the direction that we're getting is coming from MMB about the unallotment. I think that as far as the...
Madam Chair, maybe if I can answer. The Department of Health also administers the Merck program, and we're...
Part of it, yes.
And we're working in conjunction with the Department of Human Services about those unallotments and the treatment of the Merck program in the governor's biennial budget. I would just say that the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget is expecting to announce the final unallotment plan this afternoon along with the governor's budget. And so I think that all the questions that you may have related to that will be answered. But in the meantime, I would expect that would be the end or the final unallotment plan, at least based on the November forecast. Certainly the February forecast, which portends perhaps additional shortages in this fiscal year, another solution will need to be found then. So,
well, I guess I just would like to request that there be a process for notifying this division of any other unallotments that will take place regarding this fiscal year.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to pass along your request to the Minnesota Management and Budget.
Are there other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the MMB in the past you have not been able to transfer funds from different areas, like you were just saying that you could, they told you you could transfer some funds back and forth. Now, has that not been something you could do in the past?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, when I was talking about MMB and telling us when to transfer, I was specifically speaking about the unallotment process because that is something where MMB is working to communicate to agencies the steps in the process. It is very unusual to be doing unallotment.
Right,
and
so
we
don't have
procedures.
There's not a
standard process. Correct.
Because this is not the way we usually appropriate or unappropriate money. But I think since this is where we are, that I do think there needs to be some clarification in regard to the process. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I make this comment, I don't know if it's more of a comment or a question, but it's certainly not directed specifically at our two witnesses because I realize these aren't policies that, you know, that you've put together personally. You're just, you know, you're here doing your job. But I think this lack of information and difficulty with communication is just really counterproductive to what the public expects from us when we're looking at these really difficult budget times. And I would just, you know, once again bring up that's the reason we have Senate File 2 in place, trying to get earlier and more transparent communication about the budget. When we sit here hours away from an announcement and we're trying to deal with a big problem and we can't even find out what the recommendations within the agency might be about how to handle something because it's a big secret until, you know, the governor makes his announcement, that really, really is counterproductive to working together in a partnership. And when I talk to people back home about how this works here, I guess I'm new enough that I don't just take it for granted. People are just amazed at that wall that separates our communication process. And I hope you'll do everything you can to make that concern known.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, thank you for that comment. I hope that within the protocols that are in place, that we are being as open and as transparent as we can be, and know that we've had good communication with both the Senate fiscal staff and with individual members in terms of talking through kind of where agencies are at in both the unallotment and budget process. But ultimately, it's the governor's budget. And so It's his to decide how he shares that, and we as executive branch employees are bound to respect that. So,
one other message you could take back if you're in the making a list.
Checking it twice.
I have never seen an allotment take place while the legislature is in session without giving the legislature an opportunity to adjust the budget prior to any unallotment. And so I really question. Unallotment was put into the statutes to take care of unforeseen circumstances when the legislature was not in session. And so I think the need for further unallotment of this budget this year, I think, in my own mind, is questionable. Other questions? If not, thank you for your presentation today. It's been very helpful to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The last thing we have on the agenda today is sort of an update from the Department of Health. We have had technology grants going out for e-health initiatives, and okay. Maybe I can just put you on hold for a minute. You don't need to move, but my understanding, the memo we had received indicated that the department would not be available today to talk about Health Match, and they would be doing it at a future meeting, but I guess that Mr. Osberg is here today to answer questions about that issue that we raised in a previous meeting.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Osberg. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, Department of Human Services. The committee has inquired about contractors that we have working on Health Match, which is a project, as you know, to automate our healthcare program eligibility. Let me first give you an update on the project. As you know, we terminated the arrangement with a software development vendor last spring due to a lack of progress and concerns with the quality of the product that they were developing. We then completed an internal assessment that resulted in the identification of key next steps, which included contracting for a software development executive to lead DHS through an examination of the options in automating eligibility. Based on that process, we determined that it is no longer appropriate to pursue the development of a healthcare-only solution, but to develop an integrated eligibility system with healthcare being the first focus, integrating eventually with food and cash assistance eligibility. Perhaps down the road, maybe with other programs, not just within DHS. In fact, we produced a report at the legislative request to look at how best for us to integrate enrollment in various programs. Furthermore, this caused us to look more broadly at how DHS will develop systems to support our business activities across the agency in a way that was affordable and effective. We are in the process of developing a charter for this new approach, referred to as enterprise architecture, to ensure that our information systems are business-driven and program-driven. This also positions us to comply with Medicaid Information Technology Architecture, something you'll be hearing more about. It's called MITA, the federal initiative to support the next generation of systems to manage our Medicaid program and our other healthcare programs, providing, more importantly, significant financial support over time. We're talking about the potential for 90% federal money to support our systems development. Certainly, this is a huge challenge for us, near-term and long-term, as to how we're going to develop capacity to support PRISMs, the PRISM system, MMIS, and the eligibility system. This all results in the transformation of the Health Match project into this new approach and direction, requiring an examination of what resources and expertise will be needed going forward, including staff support. We currently have 32 people assigned to the Health Match project, 21 state employees and 11 contract staff, including the executive that I just mentioned. Some of these staff are intimately involved in the activities I just described.
Mr. Osberg, could you just repeat those numbers?
Yes. Total of 32 people on the Health Match project, 21 state employees and 11 contract staff. Other contract staff people are working closely on tasks that lead to the automation of the healthcare system. or key interfaces with the claim system, for example. We have contracted with these 11 staff for some time because of their experience and expertise in meeting industry standards in software development. As you may recall, in the OLA audit and the audit that we had commissioned by Deloitte Touche, they really impressed upon us the need for us to develop capacity to do to meet industry standards in terms of developing business requirements. These people are experienced business analysts and programmers. These people were not available within DHS. We need to quickly get up to speed in terms of our capacity to meet these business requirements and meet these industry standards, and also to bring on board what's called Java programmers. We have experienced COBOL programmers, but we also want to make sure that we had experienced Java programmers in order to develop this program. They complement very nicely the employed staff of the project. Together, the Health Match staff are a cohesive unit, very dedicated to their work and to this project. Now, however, we'll be addressing their ongoing role in the very near future. We're very close to deciding how best to go forward in terms of the Health Match aspect of this. We have kept them apprised of the direction that we are going and will soon be assessing how this may impact them. It's an uncertain time for our staff, and we want to make this transition in a way that is successful for DHS, but also sensitive to our dedicated staff, including those on contract. Now, we're prepared to provide more details as to the 11 people on contract, but at this point, I'm glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Well, Assistant Commissioner, my first question is, what have these 32 people been doing from May until now, since the whole project's been on hold and under reevaluation?
Yeah, Madam Chair, they've been doing two things. One is refining the business requirements with really the health policy criteria by which we then automate for purposes of the new system. To refine those, to make sure that those business requirements are prepared for any kind of solution that we develop. That definition, or what they call decomposition, is very critical in order for us to be prepared for that. Second is that we've been developing the interface necessary for our claim system, MMIS system, so that any solution that we develop is able to interface then with MMIS. We're also refining the specifics around our accounts receivable system, because one thing that this will allow us to do is do a better job of developing ability for us to do accounts receivable around premium collection. So they've been working on these issues up to this point, and they're, again, depending on how we go forward in terms of specifics around healthcare eligibility, they will may or may not be in a position to be a part of that new arrangement.
It seems like a lot of staff for what you just described you've been doing.
Madam Chair, we've had, in fact, the building that was just referenced by Ms. Rankin in terms of that was flooded. We had that staff of about 60 people in terms of Health Match, maybe 70 people at one point of our own staff. We have been bringing down the number of staff over the last year, down to 32. So it has come down. We are making these decisions as we go and based on where we want to go next with the eligibility system development. So we are bringing this level of staff down as we proceed.
And has there been money paid to the contract staff between May and now?
Madam Chair, certainly. They've been on board since that time. In fact, even before May, of course, they've been paid since May.
How much?
We can provide, we have that detail that we'll provide to staff after your meeting.
Other questions, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are these 11 contract staff the same people that the department was contracting with through this whole process that went on before that didn't work out very well?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, no, they are not. They're not
different.
With the vendor organization that we discontinued, no. They're separate organizations.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
I didn't mean did they work for the organization that you terminated. What I meant was, were they employed by these? Are these the same people who were employed by the department throughout that time so that, you know, in terms of the advice they were giving you or the oversight they were doing or whatever, I mean, are they the same people or are these new people now that you've terminated that contract?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'll go back and check that. I know some people have been on board for some time and some are new. We'll break that down as well as in terms of when they came on board. Yeah. But I would not at all suggest that these people are responsible for what happened in terms of the ACS arrangement or responsible necessarily for what happened overall in the Health Match project. They were doing their jobs as programmers or business analysts, very technical tasks that they have, and they were doing their job.
Assistant Commissioner, we've heard that the old contractor has filed a suit against the department.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
When do you expect that will be resolved?
Madam Chair, don't know that. The Attorney General's office gave us an update about a month ago, and we're not sure at what point this will proceed. They didn't have any timetable for us.
Are there other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, I have been trying to exercise my patience with this whole notion of health match. And is it a fair assessment that for the investment that has been made to this point, that we have no deliverable? And it seems that a lot of times, if we don't know what direction we want to go, or the that we choose to study it, think about it, and come back with some recommendations. And I'm wondering, that's part of the discussion, or I'm thinking that this might be an area that we want to think about maybe doing business a little bit differently going forward. And I shudder to think about the dollars that have been expended to date.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we agree that we need to take a different approach to this. That's why we're taking this enterprise architecture approach. We don't think a proprietary system exists out there today of any vendor that would make this work. So we, again, last summer reviewed the other products out there and came to the conclusion that it was not going to be in our interest to pursue a proprietary product. So we need to develop in a different way. And that's why not only this, but we also need to develop the next generation of our other systems in a different way. And that's why we're approaching this in what we call enterprise-wide architecture. So I agree with you, Senator. This point, we had the opportunity to do it better and more effectively.
Mr. Osberg, have you looked at Wisconsin? Have you looked at the system they have up and running successfully?
Madam Chair, we have looked.
That they paid a fraction of what we've paid so far for our failed system?
Madam Chair, we have looked at Wisconsin, and it's a Deloitte product, a proprietary product. What they were able to do effectively is simplify in a big way their programs, the criteria for eligibility for their programs. They have a front-end portal whereby you go in, and the back end is not necessarily all that integrated in terms of been able to do an integrated eligibility approach. They have a front-end portal that makes it easier for people to access various. But to automate the criteria, they have not necessarily advanced that any further than anybody else. We are sitting down. As you know, the governor announced a effort to work with Wisconsin at different levels in terms of seeing what come up with ways to do things differently and more effectively. And this is one thing that we're going to explore further. We've had discussions with Deloitte, and we will with Wisconsin, to see whether or not the access product that they've developed there would have application here, at least as an interim solution. And so we are open to that, and we'll be exploring that further.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Osberg, I'm not sure where to ask the questions now. this system, are we not using any of Health Match at this point?
Madam Chair, Senator Prentner-Solon, no, we do not have it. We have legacy systems. It's called MMIS and Maxis are doing our eligibility. We do not have a new automated eligibility system.
Okay, but we have everything that was worked on for, what, those 6 or 8 years that?
Madam Chair, yes, we do have
we
business
have that
requirements.
Network, and you're thinking at some point that we might be able to hook into a portion of that system to use it?
Madam Chair, yes, the business requirements that we are developed and continue to refine will hook in to the new solution, whatever it may be. And so, yes, we do have some value in what we've invested in. Clearly, it's been unfortunate and a disappointment that we have not come to a conclusion on developing a system at this point. But we're now convinced more than ever we did the right thing last spring by discontinuing this arrangement with the vendor and, more importantly, with the product that they had.
Madam Chair,
Senator.
Mr. Osberg, didn't we, in all those years that we were moving forward, was this something that was being built from the ground floor and we didn't know where it was going to end? Or did we buy something that was a system that had been demonstrated to us that it had certain capabilities? I'm just wondering why it took so many years for us to decide that it wasn't going to work for us.
Madam Chair, Senator Prentner-Solon, it's the latter, right? We hooked up with a vendor that had a product, a rules engine, that would go about automating our eligibility criteria. And we thought we had problems with it, but we thought when ACS acquired the company, ACS is an accomplished vendor in terms of Medicaid systems. Again, they had not any product, though, of their own in terms of eligibility systems. We thought there was going to be a promising result in terms of developing this, but it did not work out. As I said, there was lack of progress, and we found that the product they had was not going to meet our needs. So instead of developing it further and bringing it out there and having a unsuccessful ending, we decided to terminate the arrangement. But we did buy we bought their product, in essence, by contracting with this vendor.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator
Mr. Osberg,
Prentner-Solon.
Were we able to recoup any of the cost of that because it didn't work for us? And it seems to me that they weren't living up to their end of the contract. And the other thing is, how long is it going to be? What do you anticipate it will be before we're able to make use of that system?
Madam Chair, in terms of any recouping of costs, I better not address that issue, given that there's litigation involved in this matter. In terms of how long it would have taken to develop their system, we don't know, because we didn't. But in terms of at this point, I don't have an answer as to developing our solution, because we have not defined our solution yet. Now we're looking at an integrated eligibility approach, not just a healthcare-only approach. And we're looking at this in the context of our Medicaid Information Technology Architecture Initiative with the federal government. So we hope to have it also. It's going to be a function of what happens this legislative session. We are going to advance some proposals here to try to simplify eligibility criteria. And you'll see that in the package coming to your committee soon. We're going to try to work with you the best we can to simplify what we can in terms of eligibility criteria so that we can, whenever solution we develop, is an easier solution.
Assistant Commissioner, I very strongly suggest that before you take on everything in the department to be automated, that you get some small piece to work.
Madam Chair, again, the focus will be on healthcare. We will make sure it's going to work. We're more convinced than ever that this is the best approach to take, and we're more confident that we'll have something that does work. And that's the most important thing here, is that obviously we don't develop something that is not effective for counties or for our Minnesota care operations.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Osberg, This is the third year now that I've been here that I've heard the department say they were confident that something was going to come forward that was going to work. And, you know, considering I don't even know how many millions of dollars of taxpayers' money have been wasted up to this point, but it seems to me like there has to be some acceptance of responsibility for that, even if it is the failure of the company you hired to do their job. We also have a responsibility to oversee, to have people who know what they're doing, to know if that company knows what they're doing, to select the company, and so forth and so on. So it seems to me that, you know, I'm hearing hospitals talk about how much they're spending on software systems and integrating and working together to try to save money. I'm hearing how much money is being spent when we have 87 different counties out there trying to contract for software to do similar kinds of things, and that there are savings involved in combining. Now we have a new president who has an interest in this area. We don't know yet exactly what he's going to be doing, but I'm assuming from what I've been hearing there's going to be some assistance available at the federal level to try to help states from having to continue to reinvent the wheel among states individually. So considering the lack of progress that we've had made, if there were a bill to just eliminate the spending on this department because it's been such a big failure up to this point, until we have some direction, maybe some help from the federal government, some way that we know that we're going to use this money productively instead of just continuing to waste it, I would have a hard time understanding why that wouldn't be a better approach.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I would like to suggest that we do this, is that in April, I'd like to come before the committee and talk about exactly the approach we're looking at. We're going to be chartering this new enterprise architecture approach is how the experts reference it, and talk to you exactly about that. We'll also know at that point as to what kind of assistance there may be in terms of what I call, you know, Medicaid information technology architecture. It may be different than what's in the health information technology stimulus package, because they're not talking about necessarily eligibility systems in there, but they are talking about 90% federal money for MITA, which is more on the table today than ever. So I think that'd be useful for us to come back and demonstrate to you in April what exactly how we're going to do this, and then at that point we'll have a better sense of what where the federal government is in terms of any stimulus package that may have an effect on this.
Mr. Husberg, we're probably going to have to take you up on that, but I would just like to remind you that originally in May there was going to be a decision made about where to go and what direction to pursue in October. And it was delayed until December. In December, it was delayed until January. And now it sounds like it's being delayed until April.
Well, Madam Chair, the approach has not been delayed. The approach has been determined. The specifics will be available in April. I mentioned what approach we're going to take to this, and we're confident about that approach, and we'd be glad to come in and bring in our experts to talk about that in April as to the specifics as to how we're going to implement that approach.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, I guess just kind of following up on some of the other witnesses we've had, it seems to me that if we can't get straight answers here and we're spending taxpayers' money, that maybe what we have to start thinking about is whether we should be spending that money if we don't get that information, especially in the area of something that has wasted so much money. It seems to me like then maybe the money should be cut off until we get that information.
Well, Senator Olson, I wish it were that easy. I really do. The problem is that we have counties out there doing eligibility for many of our healthcare programs. And the demand for those healthcare programs is growing, and the counties are not able to keep up with this sort of manual methodology of determining whether a person is eligible. And so there needs to be something done differently in order to simply be able to keep the system from sort of collapsing on itself. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, but I guess what I was wondering is whether there's any possibility that the federal government may be trying to put together some kind of a system that would be more universally available to states rather than each state having to try to pay for developing its own system, and whether there's a possibility we might be wasting money between now and then if something like that would be forthcoming, or is that unlikely to happen, that we would have some more universal ability to not have to each pay to develop our own system?
Well, I think the difficulty here is sort of the old adage, if you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program. Every state has so many different aspects of their public health care programs that short of some sort of a national health insurance program, I think it would be difficult to create a computer system that all 50 states could plug into. You know, maybe they're thinking of something grander than I think they are out there, but I don't think we can hold our breath waiting for it.
Madam Chair, I think you're right. There's no talk right now about an eligibility system for the country, a common eligibility system.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, and to the committee, just to refresh our memory, Mr. Godfrey advises that the investments that we've made to date in this area are upwards of $20 million. That's very real money, and I know and I expect and that you all, too, have had any number of people parading through your offices and some that are just, you know, looking for a little piece to hang on. And so to the assistant commissioner, I would just say this. I can only imagine that when you first came to this committee with the Health Match initiative, that you certainly must have been excited and robust and ready to
Senator Lynch, let me just interrupt you
this.
A minute. This committee has never appropriated a dime for Health Match to the department. This is a program that somehow the department has gleaned this money from within their own operations over the years to advance. So there was never, I mean, we've had presentations about it sort of after the fact, but there's never, the department never came prior to the implementation or the attempted implementation of Health Match to ask for it to be made as a decision item.
Madam Chair, maybe that's a new term. Maybe I should introduce a bill and just ask that they glean something in their budget for my particular appropriation.
Right, right. I do have one caveat on that, and that is that we did appropriate every time we made a policy change after Health Match was initiated. We did have an add-on onto those fiscal notes to incorporate that change into Health Match. I'm not sure whatever happened to that money, and maybe Mr. Assistant Commissioner Osberg, you could go back and try and figure that out and let us know.
Madam Chair, we'll do that. We'll provide an accounting to you in terms of the Health Match budget.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just in light of this whole conversation that we had, I'm thinking, Assistant Commissioner, wondering what you had to think about Craig Akam's response to Senator Olson's question earlier about the communication problems, in this case some of the failed policy and the continuation over how many years has this been and the Health Match problems and failed policies, that are you actually, would you agree with his statement that you're employees of the executive and the right hand of the governor in this regard?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, yes, I am an appointee of the governor.
Thank you.
Are there other questions about Health Match? Thank you for making yourself available today, Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Golden, we're out of time. I'm sorry. We're going to have to reschedule you sometime in the near future, and I didn't anticipate we were going to have this. this additional questioning about Health Match today when we did the agenda, so I apologize.
So if you want to impose a business model on it, if they were in a business, they would have long.
Yeah,
that's true. So just follow up with the phone. $20 million, but nothing to show for it.